Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, hello, and welcome to the Tennis Podcast, and welcome to Tennis Podcast Hours, where it is 12 minutes past one in the morning, and we've just watched the final match of day four of the Australian Open be completed, and that was Maria Sakkari crashing out of the tournament to Alina Avanesyan of Russia, a young 21-year-old, and youthful Russians is going to be a bit of a topic of conversation on this podcast, so watch out for that. We are going to start, though, I think, with Novak Djokovic, who's found himself on the ropes once again, big time. Four sets once again for him tonight. Very different match to the one he played two nights ago against Dino Prismic, but a similar amount of genuine jeopardy, I would say. Alexei Popperin was a set-a-piece, doing sensational things with a sensation frenzied crowd watching him on the Rod Laver Arena. He had Xavier Malisse, didn't he, in his coaching box. He's a great presence, I think. I liked his energy in there. And he had four set points to take a 2-1 lead over Novak Djokovic. And in Djokovic's own words, in a very curtailed, I thought, on-court interview with Jim Courier after that match, he was asked, you know, what happened? How did you turn it around? And he said, I didn't. He turned it around for me. He said, he had an easy forehand and he missed it. I was lucky. How did you see it, David, from the commentary booth?
It was fascinating as a contest. Lots to it, I thought. And look, I take him at his word and I like that honesty from him about that third set. And it seemed so unlikely after the first set because he looked like Novak Djokovic in that first set to me. He was in control. He was hitting his spots. And really, Popperin was hanging on. He held on to three service games and you sort of thought, okay, is that what it's going to take for you to be competitive here? Is getting through deuce games? That's not sustainable. And he lost that set and I thought it was over, really. And coming on to the second set, which I commentated on, it turned around so dramatically because Djokovic's form just completely went. There are certain tells, aren't there, with Djokovic. He starts to fall forward on his serve and he looks a bit off balance with that. And I think some of it comes from the ball toss and so forth. But the rest of his game just fell apart. I think right at the end, I mean, Popperin got himself a break of serve and served for that set and just froze. He completely froze. He suddenly couldn't almost find the strings of his racket. And I described it in the last couple of points of that set as a dog's dinner of a set from Novak Djokovic. And it really could have been that for both players. And credit to Popperin for levelling the match at that point. And then it started to get really dicey for Djokovic because Popperin is a player that I've often thought, when he gets loose and when he gets inspired by a crowd, he's a seriously dangerous customer. And he got himself into, well, not a winning position, but certainly he should have won that third set. And then, you know, I'm sure tonight he'll be lying down thinking what might have been, because he didn't win that set.
He didn't look in full health, did he? I mean, we picked this, I mean, not just us, I think everybody that went to his pre-tournament press conference or watched it could hear that he was snuffly, and he was reaching for tissues in his pocket throughout this match. There was, I think, quite a collection of tissues discarded in the Novak Djokovic area throughout the course of this match. Thoughts and prayers with the ball kids cleaning those up. And he looks pale, doesn't he? He's got red-rimmed eyes. He's clearly not quite right. And I don't want to take away anything from the opponents that are facing him, because they are a huge factor in what's happening here. The fact that he's 36 going on 37 might very well be a huge factor here. Father Time is going to get him eventually. We don't know when it's going to be. We probably won't know that it's happening when it's happening. We will look back and be able to go, that was probably the moment that it started to happen. But we don't know if this is it, but it's probably not. But he's definitely not physically quite there, is he? And we don't know what's going on. He's almost certainly not gonna tell us how unwell he's feeling, because that's giving something away to his next opponent, who, by the way, is Thomas Martin Echeverry, who David sort of discovered this week.
You are. I was so impressed with the way he beat Andy Murray. Now, look, Andy Murray, age 36, is not Novak Djokovic, 36. They're poles apart. And also, Echeverry's now beaten Gael Monfils today as well. So he's really going through the mid to late 30-year-olds.
Yeah, the class of 2005. Yeah. He's just taken them all out.
He saved us and Gael Monfils from Monfils versus Djokovic, which yes. I think maybe we all appreciate.
I was thinking, and I said it on the radio, that's two night session matches that Djokovic has just had. Just imagine if he was scheduled in the daytime in 2 days' time and it ended up being hot against Thomas Martin Echeverry, with Novak Djokovic not feeling 100% for whatever reason. Now, it does look like it's not going to be hot. As it turns out, he may well end up playing at night. But I just think that Echeverry, he can go all day, and he's a brute of a guy. And I just think he could be bad news for Novak Djokovic.
29 degrees on Saturday. I mean, yesterday was only 30, 31 on the bulb, wasn't it? And it was scorchio.
Yeah. I suspect Novak Djokovic will be putting all the pressure that he can on to try and get another night session match. We know how much he prefers those, and he does tend to get them. But I mean, what I said during this match, as the Echeverry praise was flowing through on the WhatsApp group from David, I was thinking about it, because, you know, I really sort of trust David's take and read on these sorts of things. And to me, it's like there's absolutely no shortcuts against Echeverry. Like, and I think tonight against Popperin, okay, Popperin played some really electric tennis, and I was very impressed with a lot of his variety. He was going all Andy Murray with the sort of short ball lob combo during the middle of the match. He just sort of played that beautifully at times, and he was moving Djokovic around the court, and he had weapons. You know, it was all really good from Popperin for a lot of this match. But he also fell away in that fourth set, and he didn't take his chances on the set points. And I just don't think Echeverry will let you off the hook like that. Like, you really have to beat him. And I guess what I was surprised by is that, you know, Djokovic had a couple of days rest, didn't he? Because he played Sunday, his first match, and he played Wednesday today. I guess I was just expecting him to have recovered from whatever it was that he was feeling pre-tournament and in his first round match a bit more than he seemed to have done tonight. This does seem to be lingering. So you have to take it into consideration for his next match. Like, it might still be there. And if he's feeling like that and he's playing Thomas Martin Echeverry, it's going to be difficult for him. Of course, I still back him. It's Novak Djokovic. But you're right. It's hard just to know what to read into these Djokovic matches, because if he goes on and wins the title, it will be like, oh, well, he just, you know, he came through these tough moments like he always does. But if he does go out, or if he is beaten by even someone like Jannik Sinner later in the tournament, we might think maybe the signs were there earlier on. Mm. So it just makes for a fascinating tournament really for Djokovic right now.
Do either of you think he will play a day session match at any stage during this fortnight?
I do. I do think he will. I think that may only be one, but I do, yeah.
He might rather it be Echeverry than Shelton, who it could be the round after that.
I'm just thinking, I can't quite remember how they do the quarterfinals, but if Alex de Minaur keeps making his way through and gets to the quarterfinal against Sinner, I could imagine that would be their night session billing that day. And maybe Djokovic's quarterfinal against Fritz or Tsitsipas or whoever it ends up being. I could see that being a day session, maybe.
It's like Matt has tennis draws etched into his brain when they come out, isn't it? It's absolutely extraordinary. I want to move on next to something that happened at the very start of the day. And I can't think of a good segue between these two matches other than to say I don't want this to get lost in the shuffle, because it was such a moment, such a result. Mira Andreeva, 16 years old, already talked about for a full year by us and everybody else in tennis, 16, doesn't turn 17 till April, and yet still already very well known to the tennis fans, tennis audience, beat Ons Jabeur today 6-love, 6-2, and no, that scoreline wasn't at all misleading. It was every bit as one-sided as that suggests, and possibly more. I'm sorry to do this to you, David, but you did say someone would get a schooling in this match, and
they did.
And they did.
Yeah.
They did.
Let's just leave that there, shall we?
If only you'd been that vague and said someone.
No, I very clearly said that Ons Jabeur would give Mira Andreeva a schooling. And I was wrong, because the opposite happened. And Andreeva, my reasoning for that was some of the spectacular drop shot returns that I saw from Jabeur. And I also thought maybe Andreeva might get a little bit sort of shell-shocked by the occasion of facing her idol and somebody she's been waiting to play for a long time. And that was not the case at all. She was so composed and so ready to deal with whatever came her way. I think she was nervous. She did say that. But it didn't manifest itself in a negative way in any way. Her senses were heightened. She reminds me of a snooker player who's several shots ahead of what's going on at the given time. She'll hit a shot. We were watching it on the TV here. These are not blisteringly powerful shots. They're just perfectly placed to get an opponent off balance. And they're ones that I haven't thought of as she's lining up for them a lot of the time. And then when she plays them, you're like, oh yeah, that was the right shot, wasn't it?
She doesn't play rally balls. You pointed this out. We all watched the match together. It was the start of the day was very much rain affected, so there was only play happening on the three courts, which are lucky enough to have a roof here in Melbourne. So we're all huddled around the TV watching. I've made it sound like we're living in some sort of hut. It's an absolutely delightful apartment. We're all lounging around the TV watching this match. And David, you said just every single shot she plays has a purpose. It feels like it's part of a master plan. You know, all of the usual chess analogies that you can imagine, they're all there. She doesn't do rally balls, and it's brilliant.
Mm. And David, you said that it reminded you of Martina Hingis, who of course, you know, was so well known for her tennis IQ and her ability to sort of be one step ahead of opponents and doing it all in her teenage years as well, like Andreeva is. And I think what struck me is that so often young player against their idol, as you said, that's often a match to worry about a little bit. But Mira Andreeva just brought such, and I'm sorry for this person who's always catching strays, but such anti-Casper Ruud against Rafael Nadal energy. You know, there was no worry at all that Andreeva, once the match got going, was even thinking about the fact that it was on Jabeur down the other end. She was playing her game and she wanted to win. And I was so impressed. And I think I've never really understood the Andreeva to Jabeur analogy in terms of playing style. But what I would say is that we probably have said similar things about Ons Jabeur in the past, in that she's a step ahead of her opponents. You know, she's manipulating the ball around the court and maybe not beating players with brute force, but sort of with her high tennis IQ and shot making. And Andreeva displayed those qualities today. I was absolutely blown away by this performance. There's such safety and security hardwired into her game.
You just trust her completely. You're not thinking, God, how long can she keep this up for?
Yeah.
You feel like she could stay out there 6 hours.
Yeah.
And it's all so just deeply in her DNA. Mm. She's within herself somehow. And yet it's also quite spectacular to watch.
Yeah. And again, with Ons Jabeur, it does feel like she's playing on the edge a lot of the time. You know, when it's going well, it's brilliant. But if it's a bit tight, it can get away from her quite quickly. And, you know, that was very much a factor in this one-sided scoreline. Look, as good as Andreeva was, it's as poor as a really top player can play, I think, from Ons Jabeur. Like, she did not show up. She did not have anywhere. I mean, I wouldn't even say she had her C game. You know, it was...
Or her C attitude, maybe. Not that she didn't want it. She was dialed in. The desire is there, but sort of channeling that in a positive way, which obviously is incredibly difficult. This is, I'm speaking as somebody who is no stranger to a massive sulk. But the body language was awful. Awful out there, wasn't it? I mean, I was wanting to look away. I found it genuinely very hard to watch.
Well, it did remind me of the Wimbledon final. It looked like somebody who was in some shock, really, that it was going like this. And the issue is, how do you stop thinking about the last time that you felt like that? How do you find a way to win matches from that situation and stop it tail spinning in the future? It must be quite traumatic, really, especially somebody like her who is so clear about how much it means to her and how much she wants to achieve the thing, you know, the winning of a Grand Slam. And these results are not just about ending an opportunity now. They potentially damage an opportunity in the future, and it's not cast iron. I hope for her sake that she gets over it and finds ways to deal with those situations, but it's not ideal.
I know we love about Ons Jabeur the fact that she so states her ambitions and desires and plans in the sport. She not only put the Venus Rosewater dish as the lock screen on her phone, she told us that she put the Venus Rosewater dish as the lock screen on her phone. And for us as broadcasters and people trying to gain an insight into the sport and its players and pass that on to all of our listeners, that's a gift. She's a gift to us in that respect. But just in terms of her, I know it's the most off-putting language for journalists, but there is a reason that so many top tennis players talk about and use the phrase process, not outcome. I have heard the phrase process, not outcome. I mean, I've heard it from Tim Henman a million times and I glaze over every time. But there's a reason they're saying it, right? There's a reason all the sports psychologists are saying it. It works. It matters. It's important that you focus on doing the right things rather than the end result of those right things. If you're doing the right things, the results will come and you just have to trust that. And it does make me anxious for Ons Jabeur that she is so outcome focused. And I know we're going to do a proper discussion of the documentary that she's done at some point over this fortnight. We haven't had a chance to watch it yet, but I have seen the clip of her saying, again, laying herself incredibly bare for us and saying that she wanted to win the Wimbledon title because then she would have achieved her dream and could leave the sport to have a baby. She could let herself have a baby if she'd got over that hurdle. And I just, it stresses me out to watch this woman that's trying to achieve something, not only because she so desperately wants to achieve it, but also because then she'll be able to allow herself to have something that she so desperately wants. And it's just a lot. It's a lot watching Ange Jabeur at the moment, and I feel for her, and I wish her well. And just back to Andreeva, it didn't half underline how incredible her performance was today. The fact that the girl, I was going to say woman because you should, but they are girls. They are children. They're 16-year-olds. The girl that beat her in last year's junior final here at the Australian Open less than 12 months ago, Lina Korneva, 2 months younger than Mira Andreeva. They were great rivals in juniors, played doubles together, good friends, I think. She was blown away by Beatrice Haddad-Maia, 6-1, 6-2. I commentated on this match. It was scheduled on the 1573 Arena, and it was moved onto Rod Laver Arena because there was a gap and lots of matches were delayed because of all the torrential rain. Thanks very much, Melbourne, for that. And, you know, I was bigging it up as we've seen one incredible teenager, Russian teenager, do absolutely awe-inspiring things on this court. And Korneva will have watched that and she'll have been inspired by it and motivated by it. So what can she do? She beat her 12 months ago in the final and she couldn't do much, quite frankly. There was a gulf in class, in experience, in composure. And of course, Alina Korneva is 16 years old and making her Grand Slam debut, and she made the decision to stay in the juniors that little bit longer than Andreeva. She played French Open juniors last year, she won French Open juniors and then started making her transition at the back end of last year, but it didn't half underline what Andreeva had achieved earlier on in the day. While that match was happening on Rod Laver Arena over on the second court, Coco Gauff managed to get herself into a bit of trouble against Caroline Dollarhyde, who served for the first set, failed to serve it out, got into a tie break. Coco Gauff won that and took over. But it's very difficult to know what to make of Coco Gauff winning ugly, because that's what she did at the tournament where she had her best result and went on and won it. So maybe this is good?
Yeah, that's kind of the dilemma that I had in my mind as well. Like, it does seem to be her sort of DNA as a tennis player at the moment that she doesn't have her best game, and yet she's having the best results of her career coming through these matches. And I'm just sort of waiting for it all to click. I'm waiting to watch a Coco Gauff match and think, wow, like, she is really playing well. I can't really remember the last time that I felt that. I probably just before the US Open, actually. I think she came into the US Open in brilliant form, and that form didn't perhaps always carry through to her matches in New York, but the resolve that she'd built up and the trust in the other parts of her game that she'd built up just saw her through that tournament and continued to see her through matches. But there is a part of me that is waiting for the player who is playing really well to face her and beat her. And I don't know, maybe that's really downplaying what Coco Gauff is doing. I think she is perhaps, you know, not playing her best tennis, but maybe forcing other players to not play their best tennis as well. She's mentally handling situations so impressively. Look, it wasn't all bad today. There were, you know, there certainly were good parts to her game, but we know how capable she is, and I just don't feel like we're seeing that top level. But it's, you know, it's probably the most important skill to have as a tennis player, to be able to win when you're not playing at your best. And Coco Gauff has totally mastered that and has already won a Grand Slam title by doing that. So, you know, things are good for her.
Mm. No one's ever won a Grand Slam title playing perfect tennis for seven matches, have they? Caroline Garcia has been unable to play perfect tennis for more than one match. She is out. She lost today to Magdalena Freck. Is that the right? I wasn't expecting to do quite as big a flourish on the pronunciation as I ended up doing there, but there we are. Had a break in both sets of this, lost in straights.
Yeah, and look, I think...
maybe just the sigh is enough. Maybe we move on.
Well, I mean, I've just read some quotes she's given to L'Equipe, where she's spoken about the fact that kind of what we speculated about, you know, she was very nervous against Osaka, she said, but she also felt like she had nothing to lose. You know, she said, if I lost to Naomi Osaka, I'm not the story. Coco Gauff, Naomi Osaka winning would have been the story, all of that. And she played brilliantly in that match against Osaka. But today she said, I had a lot to lose and the pressure was all on me. And she said she struggled with her breathing on court, which is something that's really affected her, you know, recently. And she's talking about the fact that, you know, she has considered taking a break and, you know, because she just is struggling. But it's such a shame because she was so good against Osaka.
Oh, it was unplayable.
Yeah. And you always want someone to just, you know, who've made a big impression in a draw to just carry it on. And yeah,
It's a tough old sport. Speaking of which, Aryna Sabalenka has crushed another teenager today. A slightly less one-sided scoreline, but I do think I'm stealing Matt's line here. Sabalenka should not be allowed to play... what did you say? Shouldn't be allowed to play children with thigh strapping anymore. It's just not fair, doesn't look fair, does it? It is just something about the way Sabalenka plays, doesn't it? The ruthlessness, the brute power of it. It just looks cruel.
You can play well against her with a certain kind of game, and she can just absolutely take you apart, knock you off the court. For instance, I kind of feel like Amira Andreeva, as good as she is as a tennis player at the moment, she might still get knocked off the court by Aryna Sabalenka, even if she's playing well, because it's just... it's not normal, that sort of level of power. That not everybody has that. And when she's really on, she's not only a hard hitter, but she's so talented at getting angles. And yeah, she's looking really good.
She is. I do think her draw now gets a little bit more interesting. She's got Lesya Shcherenko in the next round, who I think we always class as a little bit tricky. There's obviously the fact that she's a Ukrainian player coming up against Sabalenka. Mm. There will be that aspect to that match.
More guaranteed thigh strapping.
From Shcherenko.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then if she wins that, she will face the winner of Paula Badosa and Amanda Anisimova. And Anisimova has a very good record against Aryna Sabalenka. I mean, it was here at the Australian Open 5 years ago where... as a 17-year-old, Anisimova like completely blew me away in the way that she deconstructed the Sabalenka game and beat her for the loss of just a few games. And then she did it again at the French Open a few months later. Like, she's got a good record against Sabalenka. And I don't know what to make of Paula Badosa. I'm just very pleasantly surprised that she's playing well again. She sounds pretty... surprised, and most importantly, her back is holding up so far. She doesn't quite know how she's going to pull up, I think, the day after all these matches, after so little tennis. But I was pretty impressed with what I saw today against Pavlyuchenkova. We made a point of trying to get some eyes on that match and watch Badosa, and yeah, I thought, look, I wouldn't compare the level to what she had a couple of years ago, but it was an awful lot better than what she was playing last year when she was playing. So it's just an interesting little section of the draw, that, I think.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Lots of matches there that I would definitely go out of my way to watch. Caroline Wozniacki is out. She lost to Maria Timofeva, who's a player I commentated on in the first round when she beat Elise Cornet. Came back from losing the first set today to beat Caroline Wozniacki on the John Cain Arena. So it's not been a great tournament for the comebacks, for the big comeback stories. I know Raducanu's still in. She only won the one round. Don't want to get carried away with that one. But by and large, I mean, look, these players coming back, they have protected rankings, but that doesn't get them a seeding. So they're facing tough players, aren't they? And it's tough out there. There's an awful lot of really, really good tennis players. The depth is pretty special. So, yeah, Caroline Wozniacki out. And I am awarding Sensation of the Day to Storm Hunter. And I think that's pretty unequivocal, right? She beat Laura Siegemund today. She managed to stay sane throughout the experience broadly. Sensation of the Day goes to Storm Hunter, who's into the third round.
Yeah, first time ever into the third round of a major in singles for Storm Hunter. I mean, those two are... they're opposite people, really, aren't they? Siegemund is, you know, as discussed on previous podcasts, very close to the line of what's acceptable. And, you know, I think Storm Hunter would probably win all the sportsmanship awards. You know, they're just very different in
different
that
approaches
sense.
To the game.
Absolutely. Yeah. And this was a fun match, you know, two players probably most at home, comfortable on a doubles court. So you've got a lot of variety, a lot of fun rallies, and a nice bit of revenge for Storm Hunter because, of course, Siegemund beat Hunter in that absolutely epic United Cup mixed doubles semi-final.
Yes.
just a couple of weeks ago when Germany beat Australia. They were both on the doubles court against each other and it was phenomenal. So nice for Hunter to get one over her today.
Yeah, the Aussies just love Storm Hunter. She's
great.
If they could have sort of factory made a player to cheer on, I think it would be Storm Hunter. So I think those are the critical women's results dealt with. Just before we circle back to the men, obviously we've already discussed Novak Djokovic, I'm going to tell you about our sponsors. We are proud to be sponsored by On Location throughout the Australian Open. On Location are, of course, the premium hospitality and experience provider. For the first time ever, On Location, as we've been telling you, will be the official hospitality provider of the Olympic and Paralympic Games Paris 2024. That means that you can gain unparalleled access to the Olympic Games when they happen in Paris, from Friday 26th of July to Sunday the 11th of August 2024, including access to the ultimate in hospitality with an exclusive invitation to Clubhouse 24 in the iconic Palais de Tokyo, set against a backdrop of the Eiffel Tower. Located within proximity of key Olympic Games venues and convenient metro access, Clubhouse 24 is included with your choice of event ticket. That is one of my favourite things about the Olympics. In a crowded field, the fact that it takes over a whole city and all its landmarks. I always remember the Olympic rings being erected onto Tower Bridge in London, and I went to see them going up. It was very special. You can get access to a Parisian-inspired food market in the tradition of French open-air markets with multiple catering stations, which will offer the best of French and international specialities. You can gain access to interactive sporting activities that bring out your inner Olympian. No effort needed, with a variety of physical and virtual reality activities and games. To be honest, tickets or no tickets, I might get to Paris just for that. You can also catch the latest competitions via large screen monitors. You can get access to guest concierge and a support desk, which features On Location's on-site hospitality support staff who will be available to assist or simply answer any question you might have. And you get access to live entertainment and appearances, enabling you to enjoy live musical performances, athlete and special guest appearances, and watch demonstrations, and of course much more. Just go to toursfortennis.com/podcast and select Olympic Games Hospitality. That's toursfortennis.com/podcast. Packages can be purchased there, or a dedicated on-location team member can contact you directly to create your perfect package.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life, and of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
So, circling back to the men's event, it feels like time to talk about the best tennis player in the world, Thomas Mahatch. He's only gone and come good for us.
I mean, he really does look like the best tennis player in the world when he's playing like that. No offence, Novak Djokovic. We know you're the greatest, right? But in isolation, just to the eye test, I mean, it's something we joke about because we've seen him play a single rally on a side of a court that took our breath away to the point where we were anointing him the best tennis player in the world. He played three sets today against Francis Tiafoe that were just gasp-inducingly good. I don't know what else to say. I mean, he's got everything when he's playing like that. I think the first time I ever saw him was when he played against Dan Evans, and it was in the Davis Cup, and Evans, I think he held serve, his first service game, took about six deuces. And he was trying to serve and volley against him, and he was getting passed off the clean return like it was Andre Agassi down the other end of the court. And I love that style of tennis, a great returner who's got a good hand-eye coordination, he's got a gorgeous backhand, all the rest of it. And he beat Evans that day, and I've looked out for him ever since. He's not really done much, to be honest. He hasn't really come good. And then suddenly today, you two both saw him, and let's say we were all on the same page, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm fully in on the bit about him being the best tennis player in the world. We were all there together watching him practice last year, and we were all jaws on the floor. And yet, also in the back of my mind, throughout every time that Thomas Mahatch comes up, is something that Matt Futterman said to us earlier. He's 23 years old. He hasn't had big injury layoffs or anything. Where's he been? If he's this good, where's he been and what's he been doing and why has he not made himself more relevant? And I know tennis isn't simple and linear like that, but like kind of not at all. He hasn't made himself, there haven't really been any moments at all. He's incredibly niche as a tennis interest, maybe less so after today. But yeah, he, like, what's he been playing at? I can't, after what I've seen today, I don't understand how someone so good has not been making any impact on the upper echelons of the game.
Yeah, how can there be 74 players ranked above him? I mean, he you know, because you're right, it, like, it is a bit, it still is a bit, but it's fun that it sort of started out as a bit and it might actually have
legs.
Have legs, exactly. He, and he's got
definitely,
legs.
He's definitely got legs and he wants us to know about it.
Yeah, he is of the short shorts brigade on the ATP tour. And honestly, like, his legs are part of what makes him such a good player. The way he defends from corners and can hit attacking shots. There was a couple of passing shots today he hit at sort of full stretch, which, you know, which requires incredible leg strength. But yeah, I mean, this was his first ever top 20 win. It's into the third round here for the first time. I just love watching him play. He's such a shot maker. He takes the ball so early, which I think is impressive and causes opponents problems. He's got good hands up at the net. Yeah, I just think there's so much to like. I was impressed a couple of times today. He got broken back in the second set and just immediately responded by breaking again. And he went down a break in the third set and got it back straight away. Like, he just responded well to the really high pressure big moments. There was a game he played to break Tiafoe in the second set, which honestly was a rival to Sofia Kenin's game from Love 40 down in the 2020 Australian Open final. Today Mahatch hit 5 clean winners. And look, I know Tiafoe hasn't been at his best in the last few months, but it does always take me back when someone can sort of become the main character against Francis Tiafoe. And that is what Mahatch did today with his brilliant tennis. So, look, I just hope we get to see more and more of him because he's such a good watch.
It is amazing when someone can do that just with their tennis, because he's not at all demonstrative on the court, is he?
No, he's sometimes, a couple of times today, tried to get the crowd involved.
Was it like a Hedman fist pump? Like, yeah. I feel like I should do this.
They weren't following his lead, really.
But they loved his tennis. They were in raptures by the end. The guy hit a jumping forehand, a feet off the ground jumping forehand on match point. And speaking of clutch, I managed to capture the exact moment.
I was quite taken by his on-court interview because he's clearly very aware of how good he is and how good he's supposed to be and hasn't been. And that on this day, he put it all together. And what a lovely feeling it was. And you could see the relief in his features and in his delivery that finally I've put all this together. And maybe this is the start of something.
And he won an awful lot of challenger matches at the end of last season, you know, which obviously isn't the same as doing it on the ATP tour. But there is something to be said, I think, for just accumulating a lot of wins. You know, it's not that rare that someone makes a big jump from having won a lot on the challenger tour to suddenly winning a lot on the ATP tour. And it seems like he's doing that. I spoke to him at the Davis Cup finals and said, I basically said, where, you know, why aren't you better? You know, I didn't say it in those exact terms, but he was talking a lot about mindset. You know, I think exactly as you say, he knows he's got the game, but putting it all together is something that he was still figuring out how to do. And gosh, I just hope he has actually figured it out, because
who's
I love
next?
Watching him. I believe he's got Karen Khachanov.
Okay.
Next, which looks tough. Mm. Karen Khachanov's very good at these slams.
It's, you know, a hard-court grand slam.
Yeah.
And he just keeps on
which
coming.
Which means we're not talking about him, but he's probably going to reach the semifinals. we're going to continue not talking about him. I think he won today.
He did.
He must have won because he plays so much for Hatch. Yannick Sinner also won today. I mean, he's just cruising, isn't he, Sinner? He lost just six games today to Jesper de Jong, who we don't know much about Jesper de Jong, and we'd expect Yannick Sinner to beat him. But it does feel like a corner turn for Sinner just to be taking care of business in the opening rounds of slams, like it's just routine for him like this. Taylor Fritz cruised as well today. He needed to cruise after what he went through in the opening round. Hugo Gaston won just four games against him. It's not great, that is it. But Paris is coming, Hugo. It's not the clay is not too far away. Andre Rublev was very comfortable today against Chris Eubanks, who's having a tough time, isn't he, really, since Wimbledon. It's been tough for him to string results together. And then we had two seeded players avoiding sensational comebacks. We had Ben Shelton, who looked to be cruising against Chris O'Connell, and then you realised actually Chris O'Connell had got Ben Shelton right where he wanted him, because he flipping loves to come back from two sets to love down in that sort of environment, and he gets it to two sets to one, and he's right on at him, isn't he? In fact, we had a message on Instagram saying, "I'm worried about Shelton here." How worried were you about Shelton, Matt?
Honestly, not massively, because, well, it did feel like the Chris O'Connell thing to do, to have a bit of a comeback but not come all the way back. You know, we have seen that before. And also, I think Shelton quite enjoyed being out there on the John Cain Arena. He doesn't mind that environment. He doesn't mind having the crowd even against him. He wants an atmosphere. He wants a show. And, you know, he spoke about how it was nowhere near as hostile out there as some of the college tennis environments that he's played in. I suppose I got a little bit worried for him when he did miss his match points. You know, that's always a worry if you can't convert them. But he sort of knuckled down and managed to win it in the tiebreak instead. And yeah, there does seem to be a bit of a Ben Shelton phenomenon at the moment, because I was speaking to Matt Futterman the other day, who was on court three when Ben Shelton beat Roberto Bautista Agut. And at the end of the match, apparently a lot of people were saying, "Ben, do the phone thing, do the phone thing." Like, people know about it. It's a trademark. And we met a lovely tennis podcast listener today, Riley, who was out on the John Cain Arena. And she said that she was one of those people at the end of the match saying, "Ben, do the phone thing." So, you know, he's sort of got something to live up to now, I suppose. And look, he's on a collision course, isn't he, with Novak Djokovic in the fourth round. I think everyone wants to see that match. And I sort of have been impressed with Shelton. You know, he's passed a couple of eight different tests there, Roberto Bautista Agut and Christopher O'Connell. And he's using the sort of full depth of his game to do it. So, yeah, just good vibes.
And David, you commentated on Stefanos Tsitsipas against Jordan Thompson, or large parts of Tsitsipas against Thompson. When a set down, didn't he sit to pass and won the next two, looked like he was in control, and then suddenly he finds himself in a four-set tiebreak, and it all feels like it's on the line again. He's an awkward customer, isn't he, Thompson?
He is, and I think he's playing the best tennis of his career right now. He really packages his game well, and really he should have been in a fifth set today. It was such a strange match all over the place in terms of momentum shifts, and really Tsitsipas at times early on, he looks like he's there for the taking. He loses the first set. It was a tiebreak in the second set, and he could have found himself two sets to love down. And then after that tiebreak set, he suddenly relaxed and reminded you how he got to the final last year. He was awesome in the third set. And I thought, has he just played himself into form? Because if he's played himself into form, this is a guy who could go deep into the second week. Wins that set, starts doing the same thing in the fourth set, gets himself to two match points on his own serve, 40-15. Gets broken. And at that point, you don't understand what's happened to him. And I mean, I'm afraid maybe his back was hurting, but all this tinkering around with the serve, he can't rely on the thing.
What was he doing with the serve?
It seemed to be a bit of a mixture. Sometimes he was doing the platform thing with keeping his feet still. Sometimes he was doing the little step up, but it was not going in very often, I'm telling you that.
Have you ever seen that before? Player sort of switching between two different service motions in a match?
I really don't understand what he's been trying, other than the fact that maybe the back pain is making him try to make allowances, etc. Then Thompson gets ahead in the set and has numerous set points. And really, talking to one or two people in the Australian camp of former players, it seems that this is a problem for him playing his very best tennis once he set up the chance and he's got the set point, because he just wasn't making reliable shots and getting asking enough questions. There were loads of set points, I can't remember how many. He ended up losing in four, and fair play to him, he put up a good show, but Tsitsipas would have been relieved. He was very, very warm about the crowd afterwards. It's testing, but he said, this is, you know, what I always wanted when I was a kid, when I was to play in crowds, front of crowds like this. Set three level, he could be dangerous, but it doesn't feel repeatable at the moment.
So Jordan Thompson out of the wokest tournament in the world. That's what he called the Australian Open the other day.
Oh dear.
All those fans getting to watch their tennis. What a woke.
Yeah, that was in
tournament.
Response to a question about fans being able to come and go after every game. And the Tsitsipas Slam is on.
It is.
Called it early, guys. Called it early. And that's about your lot from day four at Melbourne Park. I'll whiz you through tomorrow's schedule. Laver starts at midday. Świątek against Danielle Collins. Then Sonego up against Alcaraz. Rybakina Blinkova kicks off the night session. And it's Emil Ruusuvuori against Daniil Medvedev. Now, there's a reason why Emil Ruusuvuori hasn't been able to make himself a factor up to this point in his career. And maybe that reason will be present tomorrow night. Probably will be. But I will say that I quite often watch Ruusuvuori and I'm incredibly impressed and think, why aren't you better? I've never quite asked him the way Matt's asked Thomas Mahatch.
Tomorrow's the day.
Yeah, maybe tomorrow will be the day. But I will make a point of going out to watch that, I think, unless it's a total blowout. And then I'll pretend I never said this on a podcast. The second court tomorrow starts with sensation Max Purcell against Casper Ruud. Then Clara Burel of France takes on Jessica Pegula. Night session is Holger Rune against Arthur Cazot, the French wildcard. And then one of David's favourites that he's recently dropped like a hot potato, Clara Towson against Victoria Azarenka. Haven't mentioned her in a while.
She's just in my reserves, Catherine.
Right. Okay. John Cain Arena sees Alexander Zverev against Lucas Klein of Slovakia. A qualifier, Sloane Stephens against Daria Kazatkina. She's been doing some good tweeting recently, Kazatkina. We like her.
Mm.
She's good people. Grigor Dimitrov against Thanasi Kokkinakis is third on, and then Yelena Ostapenko against Ila Tomljanovic. So potentially scrub what I said about Medvedev Ruusuvuori, because I will be diverting all my attention to that match.
I mean, Ostapenko Tomljanovic last on the John Cain Arena after a Kokkinakis match could be a riot.
And then we have the Brick Court tomorrow. That's the 1573 Arena. Cam Norrie's up first there. Zheng Qinwen against Katie Bolter. And Emma Raducanu against Wang Yifan there. Felix Auger-Aliassime rounding things off on that court. We have our mascots. David has Francis. I have Darwin. Matt has Haider and Soma. Hello to you all. Billie Jean is sponsored by Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss. We have our top folks and executive producers, Greg, Chris, Jamie and Jeff. And we're actually not going to do shout outs today. You might have noticed, you might not have, and that's absolutely fine if you haven't, but we've perhaps been a little bit subdued this evening, and that is because just a few hours ago we got some really, really shocking and pretty devastating news, not just for us, but for the whole media room in tennis and here at the Australian Open, and in particular for the British section of that media room, and that is that the Daily Mail's long-standing tennis correspondent Mike Dixon passed away suddenly in the night last night. It's very difficult for us to process just at the moment. Mike has been an ever-present for my whole career in tennis, and I know that goes for you as well, David, and your career goes a lot further back than mine. And to say that he was much admired, I think would be a tremendous understatement. It's just the most tremendous loss.
It really is. It's nearly 30 years ago that I first met Mike, and I'd been reading his work for years before that. He was, frankly, a bit of a hero of mine from the tennis journalism fraternity. I remember reading an article about him and the other travelling journalists in a magazine called Serve and Volley back in 1995, and it detailed how they would travel the world, and he was one of the ones pictured there, and I always remember back at that time he had really good relationships with the players. He could get interviews that other people couldn't, and I would read them, and I'd really enjoy them, and then to come to work with him, or to at least be a colleague of his, I realized why. You know, he was, to my mind, the gold standard of journalism in tennis, and that has been the case ever since I've worked in it. He was the person whose articles I would read first, because I always knew I'd probably find out something I didn't know, even though I worked in the sport. And the players that he dealt with respected him. I found out this news, this shocking news, whilst I was on air on BBC Radio, and I found it out from a message from Dan Evans, because he knew him well and had been interviewed by him many, many times, and he was in shock about it, and he respected him, he liked him, and that went, I think, for all of us. Mike was somebody whose opinion I would sort of seek, and whose view, I guess, almost of me, I would hope to covet. I wanted to know if he thought I was doing a good job sometimes, and I would want to know what he thought about things, because I respected him so much, and you know, when he did give praise, it really, really left a mark, because he didn't just give it out to anybody for any old thing. Once or twice he would tell me off if he didn't think I'd done something or I was wrong about something. He would gently tick me off, you know. But even a few weeks ago, when news reached him that my dad had passed away, he sent me a note, just a little note, and kind of let me know that it would get easier to come to terms with in time, and that meant a great deal to me at the time. And it still does. And the press room tomorrow is going to be one of shock. And we're all struggling, really, to come to terms with this news. And our thoughts really go out to his family. He has a wife, he has three children, and he's going to be missed terribly.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely, David. Lucy, Sam, Ruby, Joe, his wife and children. It's devastating, and we're thinking of them, and thank you for bearing with us on this show, and we're going to keep doing them. It's going to be great. It's going to be a great tournament, but right now it's tough for us. So thank you for listening. We're going to raise a glass to Mike, and we'll speak to you tomorrow.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market. Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.